Welcome to the Water Channel Podcast, a series of conversations on water, food, agriculture, and environmental sustainability. We feature stories and insights that reflect our present and are shaping our future. This is Long Wang from Meta Meta, my pleasure to host our podcast of today. Water, the very essential resource that supports all the nations and ecosystems, is political. Sharing water resources between regions, nations, and economic sectors is often the result of a complex process of negotiating, cooperating, and sometimes fighting at wars. Nowadays, effective water-based negotiation and cooperation is key to maintaining sustainable water management in different parts of the world. Today, we will talk about the legal and institutional aspects of managing water. In particular, we will look at the complex interplays between water, insecurity, and conflicts with examples from multiple countries. It is my pleasure to welcome our expert on the topic of today, Dr. Susanna Smyer. Dr. Smyer is Associate Professor in Water, Law, and Diplomacy at the IHE Delft Institute for Water Education. She is also leading the Water Peace and Security Partnership, a science-based platform aiming to turn water crisis into opportunities for peace building. Thank you very much, Susanna, for joining our conversation. Susanna, when we talk about water insecurity and conflicts, these terms can mean different things in different contexts, and I guess also to different people. Can you help to set the scene for our conversation by introducing these terms to the audience?
Yes, you're right. Insecurity is a term that's being used in many ways. Same for conflict, actually. There's quite a bit of talk around environmental conflict, environmental insecurity, water conflict. And a lot of people associate violence with conflict. But in fact, when we look at most water and environment, but also food-related conflicts, they're non-violent. They typically happen below the threshold of war. That's definitely true for conflicts between countries over water, but very often also for conflicts between, let's say, different water users, such as farmers and herders. So that might consist of grievances, protests, people protesting against the government, people protesting against other groups that supposedly use more water or have access, better access to water than they have. But it can, in some circumstances, also involve conflict, but typically below the threshold of war, so more violent clashes between different groups. But it is indeed very important to very clearly analyze what type of conflict and what type of insecurity is happening in a certain place when we speak of water conflict or water insecurity.
At the same time, insecurity and conflicts can imply very different meanings across the levels, say for an individual compared to a security of a community or a nation. Can you give our audience some examples of conflict and insecurity at these levels?
Yeah, we can definitely differentiate different levels, starting from the individual, up to the community, up to the subnational, interprovincial, for example, further on up to the national and even the international level, where we can see insecurity and conflict. And at the individual level, that obviously concerns the very life of people and livelihoods, survival that often depends on water. At the community level, it of course affects people in the community, it affects their socioeconomic development opportunities, but very often there is also where tensions come in. If you have different communities having different interests in using water. That can be different water user groups. I mentioned the farmers and the herders earlier, but it can also just be two different villages along a river where one village is abstracting more water than the other village would like to see happening. Whereas then if we go higher in the levels, if we look at the subnational interprovincial level, for example, it's often about different provinces or different governorates using water in ways that they perceive are incompatible with each other. And then all the way up to the international level, it's conflicts like we see on the Nile or in Central Asia or between Afghanistan and Iran, where countries are competing for what they think are scarce water resources.
And listening to you, I think there's one few resources that come across as very much closely related to insecurity, that is water resources. And then also sometimes you mention food. And could you depict a picture of the common relationship that you see between insecurity, water, and food?
So I would say water is at the source, at the heart of the issue there, because very often when there's insecurity relating to food, it is related to water. It is related to failed crops or harvests, smaller harvests than people expected or people were used to because of drought, but also because of waterborne disasters. So it often boils down to water. And there, I would say we can distinguish maybe three relationships between insecurity, conflict, and water. One is where water is really at the heart of insecurity and conflict. So water is the source of conflict. And that's actually something that does happen, but that's relatively rare. The second connection that exists is the one that's probably the most common. It's water as a threat multiplying factor. So there are a number of factors that might lead to insecurity and to conflict, but water is one of them, and maybe the one that pushes things over the edge. And then the third relationship that's often overlooked but also exists is water actually being affected by conflict. So water infrastructure becoming a collateral damage in a war, or water infrastructure even being explicitly targeted, being used as a weapon, which of course then affects the availability of water, but also the possibilities of people to grow crops if, for example, irrigation canals have been destroyed.
I find it very interesting that sometimes the lack of resource leads to conflict and the other way around. Could you give some examples, some concrete cases in different parts of the world where, let's say, shortage of water leads to conflict?
Yeah, let me start maybe with the Inner Niger Delta in Mali. That is an example where water or the lack of water and consequently shortages in food and reduced livelihood opportunities have indeed led to conflict or at least contributed to conflict. So there we have the Inner Niger Delta. It's an internal river delta. It's in fact one of the largest wetlands or inland deltas in Africa. And due to climate change, but also due to upstream developments of water infrastructure, dams, irrigation structures, and so on, the delta has been affected in a way that there's less water to some extent, but most importantly, that the water availability has become much more variable. So old patterns of using the water that existed between the different users, especially between the farmers and the herders, are not functioning anymore. So there was an old system where herders would only come in with their cattle to graze when actually the farmers were done with harvesting, but with a shorter wet season and changing patterns in when water is available in the delta, these overlap increasingly and have led to conflict between especially farmers and herders. It's important to add here, though, that of course other dimensions come in. It's clearly a water-related conflict, but what makes things worse and what maybe led to the escalation of the conflict is also the fact that ethnic and religious ties come in. So the farmers have a very different ethnic and religious background compared to the herders. But also, of course, and that's again the other way around relationship, the conflict has also led to a situation in which people who used to be farmers, for example, or fishermen or following any other profession relating to water have lost their livelihood opportunities and have in turn turned towards illicit terrorist groups, which then fuel the conflict again, which makes it even more difficult to manage water, has led to a situation where there's nearly any government presence anymore, so no, let's say, official water management, water regulation. So you can see this is quite a complex relationship, but in that case, definitely water playing a key role.
Interesting. There is now an ongoing drought that we know in East Africa, and that's of the magnitude that I think deserve a lot more attention. What's your assessment of the situation, and can you give some assessment of what can we expect in terms of insecurity and conflict out of this particular drought event?
Yeah, the current drought definitely is a big problem. There has been ongoing drought over several years in Somalia, in Kenya, in Ethiopia, but definitely we see that trend worsening over the last years. And that comes in combination, obviously, with a global situation where food prices have also been spiking. due to the war of Russia against Ukraine and all the consequences that came with it. And that combination, but also together with a lot of other factors in the region, such as elections in Kenya and who knows what outcome, but also the instability that we're seeing in Ethiopia, not to even talk about Somalia, where we have been seeing instability for a long time, that together creates a situation that comes with an elevated risk of conflict. I'd say it's too early to say what exactly the outcomes will be. But if we see increasing water insecurity, rising food prices, increasing competition between communities, but possibly also between countries, because these countries also share rivers, the Omo-Giba River, the Djuba-Shabelle River, this all together definitely has an elevated risk or potential of conflict. And the question will be, to what extent will countries, but also the international community, be able to mitigate that conflict risk?
I do agree that it's probably a bit too early, but now we are talking about prediction and a bit of an, you know, forward looking into the future. It reminds me of a very important piece of work that you work and you've been contributed a lot to, which is the Water Peace and Security Partnership. Can you briefly introduce that to the audience, what it does and what's the purpose?
Mm-hmm. So the Water Peace and Security Partnership is a partnership that brings together different organizations from research, but also from peace building and environmental advocacy practitioners. And that links the water, food, energy, analytical side with the peace and conflict studies side. And one thing that the project has been doing is developing an early warning tool. So the attempt is to see, based on machine learning, based on artificial intelligence, how can we process a large number of indicators of which we know that they are relatively good predictors for conflict. And what we're seeing indeed over the last months, so the forecast comes out every 3 months, but we've been seeing repeatedly over the last months that the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia comes up as very high in terms of risk of either ongoing conflict intensifying or new conflict emerging, especially because of the droughts and the water scarcity that we're seeing, but also in relation to the limited governance capacity that is there to mitigate these risks.
I have two questions on the technical side. Could you brief the audience on what indicators are we looking at in order to tell something about the conflict?
So we're using a large number of indicators, and that's only possible with latest advances in machine learning and in AI technology. And that is because we know that water and water-related conflict and the way it translates itself, such as through food security, are always dependent on many, many different factors. There is, as I said earlier, hardly a direct link between water scarcity, for example, and conflict. So we need to know a lot about the what we call intervening variables. And that is typically governance capacity, but also the financial capacity of a government to mitigate the effects of drought, for example, so to provide subsidies for food prices. But it's often also population dynamics. It is the share of a young male population in the overall population. It is also sudden changes in population, for example, incoming refugee communities that have an effect on the recipient community. It is also the economic capacity of the population. So we use indicators on all these dimensions. So we look at water, we look at agriculture, we look at crop health, we look at energy, but we also look at changing population dynamics, different GDP indicators, education, of course, also plays a role. But we also look then at governance capacity, anything from transparency to good governance to specific water governance issues.
Great. That's on the technicality side of the prediction tool. My second question about the tool is, who are the stakeholders and who are the direct users of this tool, and what kind of finding comes out of this tool and how they are being picked up by the users?
Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to first mention that this tool is only an entry point. So we see it as a starting point for action. So as a starting point to make local, national, but also international actors aware of situations that then need further action on the ground and, of course, also further analysis. So it's an early warning tool that highlights where there is an elevated risk for conflict, not saying that this is the end of the conclusion, but rather than if an area pops up as at high risk, inviting people to do further analysis. And people who use, or organizations who use the tool, are definitely the international community. It's the UN, it's national governments. We're funded by the Dutch, but also by the German government. So these governments definitely have an interest, but also NGOs, often with the understanding that there are a lot of places around the world that need action when it comes to water insecurity and conflict. But there's, as we all know, often limited means, limited attention. Water conflicts are just one out of many, many conflict risks around the world. They're often overshadowed by more emergent or more important or more urgent crises, such as the Ukraine crisis we're seeing. So the idea is to really point those who want to act on water and conflict to the areas where either there's action needed right now, or where we see conflicts emerging, where maybe with preventive action, the escalation of conflicts can be prevented, which is typically much cheaper than intervening once a conflict has escalated.
Yeah, I understand that this tool is giving a kind of a, you know, predictive signal about the situation. Does it give also advice on any kind of action to take, or it is up to the user to decide what they should do?
So the global tool is only one of our tools, and the global tool really only has this highlighting function. So where published every 3 months, in the next 12 months, we do see conflicts continuing or emerging. But then it's like a checkup at the doctor. You find something, but you want to go a step further and find out, okay, my blood pressure is too high. Why is that the case? And then the doctor would do further analysis. And that's where then our local tools would come in, where we do a much more in-depth, thorough analysis of the water system, but also other elements that depend on it, such as food security, very important, but also energy security, and combine that with what we call human response modeling, where we try in a participatory process with stakeholders to understand what responses the population would take. If, for example, there's less water and less food produced, would they change crops that are less water intense, or would people move to the next city, or would people maybe join terrorist groups, to then see not only what is at the origin of an existing or an emerging conflict, but also what could be done in order to prevent or to mitigate it, such as supporting people to invest in different crops that might be less water intense, but that they might not have the immediate means to invest in, or provide capacity development and education. So that's really the next step that comes out of the global tool. It's really going into detail and then supporting actors in better understanding this, building capacity for them to act, and supporting dialogue that often NGOs, international organizations, and so on initiate.
It is fantastic that the prediction tool is serving different purposes for different groups of users. Where do we see the users picking up the tool and integrate these insights into their works?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a bit limited in terms of what I can talk about because it's, of course, a sensitive issue. But I'll give you two examples. So let me start with Mali, but also Niger and Chad. So we started our work in West Africa and Mali, but have expanded it with German support now to Niger and Chad. And there, not only does the global tool highlight a need for action there, but we have employed our local tools with the stakeholders. So really brought together farmers, herders, fishermen, but also the local and national security authorities to, first of all, discuss what might be the linkages between water, food, and insecurity and conflict, but then also do participatory modeling, as we call it. So really bringing people around the table. We've created a dashboard with which people can imitate different scenarios, so they can see, okay, what happens if a dam is being built upstream? What happens if the water availability in the delta changes this way or that way? And what options would people have to respond to that? And which of these options are desirable from a water management, but also a conflict prevention perspective? And which ones aren't? So obviously people resorting to violence is an undesired option. People may be changing crops and planting more resilient crops is a desirable option. And we have also used this tool to identify in the broader region very specific hotspots in which, for example, the German Development Cooperation together with the EU now is developing action plans for specific response. So they're using the tools and the dialogue that we supported to identify with the stakeholders what what responses could be taken? Is it like digging new wells? Is it changing crops? Is it setting up local water user associations to make sure that the competition that exists over water does not escalate into outright conflict? And to give you the other example of Iraq, there we work with the national government, but also with the governorates, focusing on water allocation. So water is being allocated between the different governorates in Iraq in a way that not all the stakeholders, especially in the south, in Basra, the most southern, the most downstream province, that's not considered by everyone but as fair or as the most adequate. At the same time, the entire country is struggling with water scarcity. So there's probably never going to be a situation when everyone's satisfied and says we have enough water. So we're working with them to find more sustainable, but especially also more conflict sensitive ways of water allocation by understanding who's using the water, what are the mechanisms behind allocation, what are the actual needs of the governorates, and there, and I think that's the most important, going beyond what a governorate authority would say and really trying to understand where are the needs, what are people's needs, also to address the protests and the grievances we've seen over the last year. I mean, 2018 has seen severe protests and violence by the local population in Basra because of water, or rather because of a lack of water and the health impacts that that had on the population. So making the government aware of that and working with them to find a solution in spite of the very, very challenging situation in Iraq where there's not enough water for everyone anyway.
And what is now on the table in terms of the research and development and probably I think also advocacy agenda for this tool to reach out to more users in more different parts of the world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have quite a full agenda, lots of plans. The project currently runs until the end of 2024, but of course we intend to continue it, working with the partners that we currently work with our funders, the Netherlands and Germany, but obviously also expanding that network. We're working on a number of fronts there. We're currently developing an improved version of the machine learning forecasting tool. So the new improved version will be launched in December this year in a big event. So we'll be able to even more precisely forecast and develop early warning for water-related conflict. We're also expanding our work. We're currently working in Mali, Niger, Chad, Iraq, Kenya, and are just starting in Ethiopia, but also have a few requests from other governments, but also international organizations to expand that work. And of course, we also aim at raising the global awareness. So very often national governments are very well aware. They might not openly talk about, but they're very well aware of water-related conflict risks, but might need support from the international community or individual development partners when it comes to capacity development or to implementing solutions. So we can help in identifying solutions that can help prevent or mitigate conflict, but implementing them requires much more resources. So we're also trying to link the national or local actors with the international community that could support such action.
Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts on the next steps. Those are indeed very exciting yet ambitious research and development agenda points. I would like to wrap up our conversation here and wish you a lot of luck and success with continuing your meaningful research pathway. Hope to talk to you soon again on the Water Channel. I would also like to thank our audience on the Water Channel for following our podcast series. Please stay tuned for our upcoming releases. Until next time.